This is 89.3 KPCC, Pasadena, Los Angeles, a public service of Pasadena City College, a global community college for the 21st century with vocational training programs for today's jobs.
From the Moan Broadcast Center at Air Talk, I'm Larry Mantle. Good morning. A top Al-Qaeda operative was killed earlier this week in Pakistan's tribal areas. He's one of some 2,000 militants who've reportedly been killed by drone aircraft. As wars become more and more automated with drones, what are the ethical implications of that? And what about copycat attempts, like the allegation that a Massachusetts man was planning his own domestic drone strike on the Pentagon and Capitol? It's Air Talk on KPCC.
It's 11:06 at 89.3 KPCC.
Coming up later this hour on Air Talk, filmmaker Errol Morris, his new book, Believing is Seeing, Observations on the Mysteries of Photography. Fascinating collection of essays with photographs where Morris takes a look at some of the subjective images created and how we react to them, absent the larger context of how those images were created. We're going to hear what he has to say about that and can also talk about his most recent documentary, one of my favorites of last year, Tabloid. But first, we turn our attention to the real world of robot arms. That's right, to drones that are used more and more in the theater of war. Some 2,000 militants are said to have been killed by drones operating every place from the tribal regions of Pakistan to other portions of the Middle East, where the United States is involved in military operations. And then you have a domestic example of a man who's accused by the FBI of planning to use drone aircraft for attacks against the Pentagon and the U.S. Capitol in Washington. He was arrested yesterday, 26-year-old physics graduate and model hobbyist. So even domestically, there appears to be an interest in using robotic attack methods to go after targets here in the United States. The increasing use of drones raises a number of ethical issues. Sure, you could conceivably save thousands of lives of American soldiers, military personnel generally, by using drones and be able to target the enemy much more precisely. But the question is also, do you remove yourself then from the human decision that comes from face-to-face warfare? Joining us is Ron Arkin. He's professor at the Georgia Tech School of Interactive Computing. He's published extensively on autonomous systems and has conducted research under funding provided by U.S. Army and Navy. Professor Arkin, thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here today. Thank you.
So share with us what ethical drone use is. How do ethics, in your view, how can they be and are they being applied to robot warfare?
Well, there are many different questions associated with the use of increasingly autonomous robotic systems for the battle space. Some of them deal with the lowering of the threshold of entry into war. And if you look at just war theory, which our President Obama recently spoke to at his speech for the Nobel Prize, the question is, will this new technology make us perhaps engage in adventurism more easily? Other aspects include making sure that we adhere to the fundamental principles of the laws of war, which include discrimination associated with the distinction between combatants and non-combatants, as well as proportionality, making sure that we are using the correct weapon for the appropriate task militarily.
So you're doing research into autonomous drones where information can be fed in on a specific target, perhaps even facial recognition technology coming into play, and the drone makes the decision, I put that in quotes, as to whether the person is going to be killed. And that seems loaded with all kinds of potential concerns. But realistically, how far are we away from drones that can be programmed to make those distinctions?
Well, lethal autonomy, which is what you're referring to, actually already exists in some cases. If you look at things as simple as landmines, by some roboticist definition, they have the ability to sense their environment in a very primitive way, and for anti-personnel mines, without discrimination, and actuate, in this case, through the explosion that they occur. More sophisticated systems already exist, such as cruise missiles and the Phalanx system, which is deployed on Aegis-class cruisers, which is turned on by the captain and then automatically looks for a particular target signature and engages that target without any additional intervention. This whole notion gets to the question of a human in the loop, and what does it mean to have a human in the loop? Does it require confirmation of every possible target immediately before the deployment of lethal force? Or is it something at a much higher level, like a leader in the loop, where supervisory control is given to take that building using whatever force is necessary? These are some of the important distinctions that are yet to be resolved. But the important aspect is that these decisions are being moved further and further towards the so-called tip of the spear, towards the decision-making being made by the machine and less so by the human being due to the ever-increasing battlefield tempo, the speed at which humans have to make decisions due to high technology. And that is a serious concern, and one in which we need to be careful and circumspect is how we move forward.
We're talking about the ethical and practical issues raised by the increasing use of drone aircraft to target enemies of the United States. What do you think about the trend? How do you weigh the pros and cons, and where do you come down on this? We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page at kpcc.org. Also with us is Peter Asaro, founder of the International Committee for Robot Arms Control and professor at the New School in New York City. Professor Asaro, welcome.
Thank you, Larry.
What are your biggest concerns about the increasing reliance on drones?
Well, we have multiple concerns. We're concerned about the increasing automation within traditional militaries like the United States military that Ron's been talking about. But we're also concerned with the expanded use of targeted assassination and killing that we're seeing in Pakistan, and now we're seeing the bases extending to Somalia and actions in Yemen as well. And as well as the kind of proliferation that the increased development of these kinds of technologies are going to lead to, which is the fact that there's at least 40 militaries around the world developing these kinds of technologies, that you can have domestic terrorists like we saw this week in Massachusetts trying to develop these kinds of systems for terrorist attacks, as well as the kinds of arms races that could emerge between nations as they escalate the development of these kinds of technologies.
But if this is taking place all around the world, does that really force the United States, even if it's at the forefront of this, to continue doing this kind of research and push in this direction just because you can't hold back the technology?
I think that's a definite danger, and that's the kind of motivation that you have for arms control regimes, that countries can see that it's in their mutual interest to accept a prohibition or a ban on the further development of a technology because it's in their mutual interest not to devote vast amounts of resources into that kind of arms race.
Is part of the problem with drones, in your view, the very efficiency of it? For example, if there's an action that's based on faulty intelligence to begin with, you're going to have an efficient strike, more likely than not coming from a drone, where if you've got a contingent of soldiers who are carrying out a mission, there are a lot of things along the way in the less efficient means to stop them from acting on bad intelligence. I mean, is that part of this?
It is. The sense in which the efficiency of the system and the lowering of the risk to the soldiers and combatants who use that system, I think, lowers the threshold with which they decide to use lethal force, because they don't have to risk their own lives necessarily. Or if you look at what's happening in Pakistan, that, you know, they're only for very high-level operations like Osama bin Laden are they going to risk a SEAL team or a special forces commando unit of some kind, whereas as for drone strikes, the risks are much lower, and we see many more these sorts of assaults being made in northern Pakistan.
From just sort of a human ethical perspective, is there a difference between the sealed raid that was carried out that killed Osama bin Laden versus had that same mission been carried out successfully by a drone? Would it somehow matter that one has humans on the ground carrying it out versus a machine?
In terms of international law, I don't think there's a significant difference. And in terms of the ethics of it, I don't think there's a significant difference. If it's a criminal that could be apprehended, then then you should be apprehending them. Now, in the process of apprehension, when you have the commandos in the building and the suspect is armed and is attempting to kill the people who are apprehending him, then they have a right to self-defense. So that does change the ethical criteria of using lethal force, and in that sense can justify it, whereas a drone would not have the justification of self-defense to use to justify killing the suspect.
We have a listener, Amir in Upland, who asks, what about the threat of hacking? Are foreign agents likely to come up with ways of being able to take over drones and to use them against the person who's implementing a drone strike, Professor Arkin?
Well, anything is possible, of course, but our Department of Defense has stood up a cyber command, which is focusing specifically on the issues regarding information security. And this is not just regarding drones. It affects the whole battlefield of the future. The way in which the military is moving is into something referred to as network-centric warfare, where the battlefield will be, to some extent, interneted and information will be shared. If an adversary has the capability of taking that down, then it's not just a problem regarding drone strikes. It's a problem regarding the way in which our military will operate. And, of course, it's a serious concern. There has also been times when even a relatively unsophisticated enemy, such as the Taliban, have been able to tap into the video feeds coming from our drones already, largely because they have been unsecured and have been able to see the data coming back from them. So, yes, it is a concern, and there are many concerns. That just happens to be one of them, but that problem, I do believe, is being effectively worked currently.
Hank in Pasadena, you're on Air Talk.
Hi, I respectfully disagree with your guest. I literally do not see any ethical issues that we're talking about, and I think his last comment in response to your question about the difference between a drone and a special strike team is particularly apt. It's an issue of cost-benefit analysis. How much does it cost? How much harm are we putting in away soldiers versus the hundreds of thousands of dollars it costs? If you put a special ops team in there, they're not going to be calling central command right before they do it. They have orders. If we decide there's a problem and we can't tell them, then that's the way it's going to happen. And as far as the issue of justification, I'm not even sure if that's correct, because if we're putting ourselves in harm's way by going onto someone else's property, I don't think the fact that they shoot us is gives us self-defense when we had no legal grounds to be there in the first place.
Hank, I appreciate your call. Peter Rosaro, you want to comment on that?
Well, that's the extent to which the operations themselves could be illegal under international law, and in both cases it could be illegal. So I would agree with the caller. The right to self-defense in terms of combat, if you justify this as a military action or attempt to justify that as a military action, then I think that does change the right to self-defense argument. However, we don't know exactly what legal justifications were given, and more worryingly, these sorts of precedents of taking the use of force across international borders without securing any kind of agreement between the country that you're operating in or any kind of approval from international bodies, the United Nations, something like that, is a very dangerous precedent, which the U.S. has been exercising very aggressively, and it's just a matter of time before other nations who have similar capabilities or develop those capabilities are going to be executing drone strikes of their own across international borders.
Peter Rosaro, can you hold the thought once we get back from our newscast? And I want to ask you about the first part of Hank's question where he said, isn't this really a simple cost-benefit analysis? It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Drone technology, it's increasing reliance on drones in theaters of war. Our topic, we're at 866-893-KPCC. Hedy Lynn Hurdies has the news.
Larry, China has taken another step toward its goal of becoming a major power in outer space. It launched an experimental module today to lay the groundwork for a future space station.
Chance for you to weigh in on the increasing use of drone technology in war. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're speaking with professor at the Georgia Tech School of Interactive Computing, Ron Arkin. He's someone who's written and done research extensively on the growing field of autonomous systems using drones that can be programmed and then make their own distinctions about when to carry out an attack. Peter Rosaro with us, also the professor at the New School in New York and the founder of the International Committee for Robot Arms Control. So what do you think? We're at 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page at kpcc.org. We've had a listener, Hank, challenging Professor Rosaro's perspective that there were additional ethical implications raised by a more frequent drone usage. You said, isn't this really a cost-benefit analysis, Professor Rosaro?
Yeah, there is a cost-benefit analysis, but when you're considering human lives and the costs of losing human lives, the equation to monetary value is very difficult to make. And human decision makers and officers in the military have to make those kinds of decisions of what's a risk that's reasonable to take and what's an unreasonable risk to take. And as you automate that process, I think that's a very dangerous thing. And as you have more and more opportunities to use these kinds of fully automated systems and eliminate the human risks of your own soldiers and troops, I think that inclines one to use force and lethal force more flagrantly, perhaps, because you are not putting your own lives at risk, but you are thus putting the lives of civilians at risk at a greater rate.
Professor Arkin, you disagree with that?
Well, I'm not sure that's the right question exactly to be asking. The real question that we're confronting here now with the advent of this new technology is, does it constitute what's referred to as a revolution in military affairs? Is it something that's fundamentally different than existing new weapon systems? The debate is out on that. I mean, RMAs, revolution in military affairs, refer to things such as the longbow or gunpowder or battleships, things that really change the way in which wars were waged. And then, if indeed the advent of autonomous systems and autonomous technology does constitute that, which I actually do believe it does, then the question is, does existing international humanitarian law that's encoded in the laws of war, such as in the Geneva Conventions, adequate to cover those systems? Some of us believe that indeed currently that is the case, but the discussions are ongoing. And what's really important from an international perspective, and that's why I'm happy to be on this program today, is that we talk about these things and try and understand what are the fundamental limitations. There are ethical implications in warfare. When you're killing people, there are ethical implications. And whether you're using a utilitarian ethical framework, a cost-benefit analysis perhaps, versus a deontological or rights-based approach, you have to come up with things that our nation subscribes to in terms of the just war theory and the agreements that we purport to adhere to, such as the Geneva Conventions.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying that we have come so far in weapons technology already that distance between the individual engaged in combat with another individual, we're so far from that already that this doesn't represent necessarily a game changer when we talk about autonomous drones?
Not necessarily. No more than when artillery was invented, for example. Again, that was a fighting at a distance as well, too.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had a battleship that could shoot further than the destroyers or cruisers on the other side, that could also be construed as so-called risk-free warfare, or at least risk lowered warfare under those circumstances. And I should mention our warfighters in Creech and Nellis, who are flying these particular aircraft, are not immune from the post-traumatic stress disorder and other conditions that warfighters find themselves subjected to. So we have to be careful about constituting risk in what that exactly means.
Mark in downtown Los Angeles, you're on Air Talk.
You've got a big collateral damage problem because the soldier can tell the difference between a 10-year-old child and a combatant when they have a rifle and they have a scope. The drone can basically look at something and decide that thing is a target and blow up, 20 children in a schoolroom. And it makes the United States, forget about anything else, public relations, we look like cruel beasts.
Ron Arkin?
Yeah, it's true if it's not done properly. And these systems should not be introduced until they can guarantee that we have achieved a level of performance equal to or greater than a human warfighter. I would also add that current use of drone technology as it's being flown in Iraq or Pakistan, let's not deal with a national sovereignty issue here. What happens is you have more time to make rational decisions. You have what's referred to as persistent stare. These warfighters can look at targets for much, much longer than an F-16 fighter pilot could possibly do in coming in, bring other eyes to bear on the target, and discuss this with lawyers before they engage. That doesn't mean that this is not going to produce collateral damage, but it can potentially result in lower collateral damage than would be the case otherwise.
Professor Arkin, do you think that the current use of drones has led to more deaths of innocent civilians than had you carried out these kinds of actions using ground forces or conventional means?
We don't have the data for that, and a large amount of those actions are conducted by the CIA. And thus they're not transparent to inspection. As such, I cannot effectively answer that question, but I do believe that there is a reason that there are explanations that could account for a reduction in potential collateral damage if this is done properly. There are those that argue there's something such as a PlayStation mentality. Philip Alston at the United Nations, for example, I think may have coined that phrase, or some other philosopher which he may have used. Which may have used that term. And that refers to this numbed killing, this distance that is introduced by operators that are sitting thousands of miles away. But to my knowledge, there has not been any scientific studies to verify that at this point in time. And my direct interactions with some of the operators from those bases make me think that that is likely not to be the case.
Professor Asara, what do you think about that?
There's several questions there.
Well, let's take the last one, though. This idea is sort of the video game operator idea that the distance changes judgment.
Yeah. I mean, there are other kinds of systems that that have this kind of standoff, long remote operation, and that it has been shown to sort of reduce people's reluctance to use lethal force. On the other hand, the kinds of long-term observations that these current systems are using, where you're really watching a video screen for 8 hours before you decide to fire a missile at a house, and then you see the bodies being pulled from the rubble and things like that, is a very kind of intense experience that doesn't dehumanize the war fighting in a sort of PlayStation video game sort of mentality. It's a very kind of intense experience. And because you have that ability to deliberate, like Ron said, then I think in many cases these sorts of technologies are actually improving ethical conduct. Of course, this is not automating it. This is providing humans with the kinds of information that they need to make better decisions about the use of force. And what we're really opposed to is, on the one hand, the illegal use of that kind of technology. On the other hand, the automation and the elimination of the human judgment and reasoning that makes those kinds of decisions better in the current kind of operations.
Adam in Newport Beach raises the issue, says, how is this any different from a naval warship in the Persian Gulf shooting a missile from miles away? Drones can, in fact, be much more accurate than the naval warships that are firing from a distance. Share your comments on the AirTalk page at kpcc.org or call us now at 866-893-5722. Ron in Van Nuys, you're on AirTalk.
Hi, Larry. Basically, I'm wondering, what if you use the drones as an offensive measure, such as the president of Afghanistan that just got killed? What if there were micro drones or nano drones able to sense the bomber and annihilate him before?
Yeah, the former president of Afghanistan, I think that was last week that happened. Professor Arkin, what about defensive capabilities?
Well, the military is indeed investigating small micro autonomous systems, not currently with lethal capacity, but understanding how these can be used for surveillance and recognition of targets to detect threats in these sets of circumstances, as you describe. That's for the military to decide to some degree as to how these systems will be deployed. So one is the creation of the technology. And then the second thing is the appropriate use and the legal and ethical appropriate use of this particular technology. Is there anything that in that particular mission that violates the fundamental principles of discrimination, military necessity, proportionality, and humanity that are adhered to, that are required in the international laws of war, perhaps or perhaps not. It depends how the details, the devil's in the details, so to speak. So I would say that we have to flesh out what the nature of the mission is, the CONOPS or concept of operations that is associated with these kinds of tasks, and then make sure that before any autonomous system of any way, shape, or form is introduced into that, it can reliably, effectively adhere to those laws.
Tom in Pasadena, you're on Air Talk.
Yeah, hi, Larry.
Hi.
Professors. The problem in irregular warfare is that you're dealing with non-uniform combatants, and UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, are very limited in the offensive. In fact, they're almost constrained in the offensive roles and in the defensive roles. They require human intelligence or humans on the ground. So there's a problem with in irregular warfare. The United States cannot win such a war. Only the government in place, the friendly government, can. And the longer the presence or the more evident the presence of U.S. forces, the less legitimacy the government has. And these are ideological wars. They are not just killing enemies. It's not a body count.
Tom,
so I think that UAVs are very, very counterproductive.
Tom, I appreciate your call. Professor Arkin.
That's a good point. And to be candid, I do not recommend the use of these particular autonomous systems in counterinsurgency types of operations such as you were describing. These are not the only threats that our nation is confronted with. And these systems that I've been referring to, these autonomous lethal systems, are not ready for prime time yet. We still have state actors which can lead to more sophisticated forms of interstate warfare where, indeed, there is a probability that these systems will provide a significant technological advantage, asymmetry in our favor. For example, right now, imagine if our enemy could take down the links back to Creech. What would these systems be able to do? They would just have to circle around or go back and land because there is no way for them to autonomously continue on their mission. But suppose a more sophisticated state actor, which has the ability, as one of the callers mentioned earlier, to knock down a link. Should that system have the ability to continue on target and continue its mission, even though it lost the human commander in that case? Some would argue if that could be done in a manner that is consistent with international humanitarian law. And again, I emphasize the importance of doing discrimination correctly, the distinction between combatant and non-combatant. Then and only then can we endow these systems with that particular capability. Otherwise, I agree. In situations, and until the technology gets to that particular point, it's not there yet, we have to be very, very careful how we introduce this stuff into the battlefield.
Professor, Georgia Tech School of Interactive Computing, Ron Arkin, who's written extensively and done research on autonomous systems, funded by U.S. Army and Navy to do this research. Professor Arkin, we appreciate your being with us. And Peter Asaro, founder of the International Committee for Robot Arms Control, professor at the New School in New York. Professor Asaro, in closing, what is it that your robot arms control group is seeking to do in the way of limitations, either on the research or the activation of these kinds of autonomous drones?
Well, right now we're looking at the kind of framework for doing an international ban on fully autonomous lethal decision-making that would be modeled after the anti-personnel landmines or cluster munitions sort of treaties that are have been recently adopted internationally. We also have concerns about these other issues that we've discussed, but that's our primary goal at this point.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate your being with us. Peter Asaro of the New School in New York and the International Committee for Robot Arms Control. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, noted filmmaker Errol Morris. His new book on our perceptions of photography and how the photographic image taken out of its context yields all kinds of fascinating conclusions.